Welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper doing very, very well and planning his return to WLRN. Just don't know when yet, but we hope it's soon. Well, many of us take the natural beauty of Florida for granted. Perhaps we've become inured to the wonders that surround us, or we're too plugged in to notice, or maybe we've yet to discover them. Sometimes it takes someone transplanted here to bring them to our attention. Florida Atlantic University creative writing and English professor Andrew Furman takes on what he calls the real Florida in his book, Bitten, My Unexpected Love Affair with Florida. Although in his 17th year in the Sunshine State, he says he feels as though he's in the early passionate throes of this love affair. Andrew Furman joins us by phone from Boca Raton. Welcome, Professor Andrew Furman.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Pleasure to have you with us. Before we learn about what you've come to love about Florida, give us an idea of what you feared and dreaded life would be like here while you were in Pennsylvania.
Good question. Well, I suppose that, I came out of the academic world. So I think part of it was that, you know, I was coming to a university down in the southeast where it was supposed to be so humid and hot, and it wasn't one of those touted Ivy League schools up in the Northeast, so that was part of it. I think also the stereotypes of Boca Raton were already pretty prevalent where I was, that it was a place where people just went to retire. So I think I sort of had that, God's waiting room sort of image in my mind, which
right.
was completely unfair, I discovered shortly after moving down here.
And what else? And what about the bugs and the alligators the mosquitoes and
all of that was probably in my head at the time. I really didn't imagine that I would, being in Pennsylvania for about 10 years at that time, I really had grown to really enjoy Pennsylvania for one thing, that kind of deciduous forests up there, and that's where my family was originally from. So being down in the subtropics really wasn't on my radar screen. But I was fortunate enough to be hired by FAU, and so I came down here. And it took me a few years. And one of the things I mentioned in the book is it did take me a few years to really open up my eyes. I was spending a lot of that time, the first few years, just inside, not really getting outdoors too much, trying to write my scholarly articles so that I could earn tenure. And then I just sort of noticed what happened. Is I started to notice outside my window all these amazing, sort of natural things. One thing I noticed was this little yellow bird. I just remembered this very vividly, a little tiny yellow bird with very distinctive chestnut cheeks. And I didn't have any idea what it was, but it wasn't very hard to look up and discover that it was a Cape May warbler. And then I was wondering why I didn't see it more often. And then I did more research and figured out that that it was in the middle of its spring migration, and that in South Florida we're in what's called a flyway, where birds migrate back and forth to their breeding grounds and their winter grounds from between the tropics and the Northeast and Canada. So from there, things sort of snowballed from there in terms of which is a terrible metaphor I realize for Florida. But I started to notice more and more about natural Florida, whether it be these sort of live oak trees on my college campus, which I didn't even know were oak trees because they didn't look like oak trees to me, or screech owls I would notice in my neighborhood. I'd hear about this fish called snook, which sounded like a made-up name to me. I just wanted to learn more about these plants and these animals. And so I began researching them. And then it became just really a baby step for me to really turn that into my work, to start documenting these experiences of coming to know these aspects of natural Florida. And what would turn into the chapters of Bitten. So I had about half of them written before I even realized that I was writing this book with this unifying thread of discovering these various aspects of natural Florida.
That's interesting. What do you think it is about Florida that turns you into this, William McKean, the editor of Homegrown in Florida, called you Florida's transplanted Thoreau?
That was very kind of him.
Yeah.
And very humbling. I think, to be honest, at the time, I was also reading a lot of Thoreau. And, Thoreau, especially toward the end of his life, started to look more and more carefully at his very local place. And that happened to be Concord for him. So I think in some ways I was influenced by Thoreau himself and his writing, and it made me want to know this particular place that I was living in. I really, in some ways it just happened to be Florida. So I really was interested in, you know, I realized that we enjoyed it here. We were going, my wife and I were going to stay here. We were going to raise a family here. And I really wanted to learn, you know, to get to know Florida itself, this actual place, get some dirt underneath my fingernails. And once you start doing that, you know, and I mean that really literally, because gardening is one of the things that takes up most of my time, you know, things just sort of progressed from there. And part of it might have been, to elaborate a bit, it might have been a response to, what, you know, the World Wide Web. I think that we live in this internet age, and we call it the World Wide Web, where every place and any place is available to us at all times. And there's a great thing about that, certainly. But the corollary to that, which I find in my daily life, is that when you're every place at one time, you're also no place. And so I think part of writing the book and wanting to know about Florida was me resisting that, this internet age a bit, and wanting to know my actual place, not just, you know, the virtual place. So that was part of it as well. Even though in a lot of ways, as I sort of suggest in the book, I'm not completely anti-internet. The internet is a wonderful resource, and can help us engage with the natural world. It's all over the book, really. I mean, when I wanted to build a screech owl nest box with my son, all I had to do was get on the internet, and I had like 5 or 6 building plans within 10 minutes.
Right, right.
And when I wanted to go see a certain bird, I can get on the Tropical Audubon website, and I have, you know, reports from just the day before or that morning. So, you know, I think the internet, I have a sort of a complicated relationship with it, like maybe a lot of us do, where I think something about it, you know, it's a great resource, and I think we're sort of hardwired to respond to it and to engage with it. It's sort of like simple carbs, maybe, you know, we just sort of want it, we respond to it. But it has to be used in moderation.
That's interesting that you say that, because just earlier this month, we had a journalist on from Canada, Michael Harris, and he had written a book, The End of Absence, and prescribed the same thing, that it's like sugar and fat and salt. Yes, that it just needs to be, you know, used in moderation.
Yeah,
and
I think it is. I think there have actually been, you know, studies about this, that those visual images, and these web designers know about it, you know, we do respond to those visual cues in a very instinctive way, in a similar way that we respond to simple carbs. Yes, but the moderation is key.
Yes, and I think one of the things we talked about is what he thought Thoreau would think if he was born in the age of the internet. What do you think?
Actually, you know, I think people always think I'm going to say he would have hated it, but I actually think he would have really loved it in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. He would have loved a lot of parts of it. When he was toward the final years of his life, he was actually working on really a spreadsheet about Concord. So every date through the several years, he would have a spreadsheet of what particular flower was blooming or what or going to seed at a particular date and time. And he was transcribing this all in a very complicated sort of spreadsheet. And I think he would have just loved the capacities of the internet to help him with that project.
Right.
So in some ways, I think he would have been very enticed by it. But at the same time, I don't think he would have given up on his 4-hour walks a day either.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So when did you develop this love and thirst to know more about these live oaks?
Okay. Well, I think it was pretty early on. It's one of the reasons we bought our first house, was that they had these beautiful trees in the backyard that we discovered were live oaks. I mean, at the time, you know, for a northeastern person, you know, they don't really look like oak trees because the leaves are so much smaller than our oaks in the northeast. And people said they were live oaks. I would say, well, of course they're alive. You know,
right.
I didn't know that was a specific type of tree. But, you know, on a college campus at FAU, we had several really big old ones. And they were starting to fascinate me because they were so beautiful, firstly. But I also sensed that they weren't originally there, because I knew that the campus had been an Army airfield during World War II, and that it was cleared, I had heard, of most of its foliage. And so I asked a bunch of people at FAU, it's a story in and of itself, trying to find the story of these trees. But what I eventually discovered was that they were rescued, essentially, from the I-95 construction project in Boca Raton. It's hard to imagine any time when the I-95 wasn't rolling right through my or near my campus. But in the early 70s was when it finally was linked up there, apparently, just about half a mile from my campus. And all these big, enormous, beautiful oak trees were tagged to be removed, to be basically destroyed, to make room for the highway. And it took a math professor at FAU at the time in the early 70s. His name was Jack Freeman. And he really lobbied to save these oak trees. And it was a very complicated process because you don't just remove an enormous tree. It takes heavy equipment, for one thing, but also time to root prune them and come back after, for a period of several months. So
right.
he had to get the Governor Askew involved, supported the project, and several volunteers, several donations from various environmental organizations. And they saved upwards of 100 and more oak trees and transplanted them onto the campus. And fortunately for me, he was still alive. He had recently passed away, but Jack Freeman was alive, and he took me on a tour of the campus and pointed out trees that he was particularly impressed with and proud of. And so that was the story of the live oaks on FAU's campus.
Yeah, it's a great story. So is the story about this, I guess it was the end of the semester and they had planted a new one and mm-hmm. you found it and you were, you know, wanting to kind of announce it and there wasn't a plaque. And then all of a sudden,
there was a plaque.
Yeah, yeah, which is
interesting. I think it's an interesting moment when I contemplated that, you know, that we have these plaques for these trees and that we announce, we know which tree is the largest. The state champion live oak tree in Florida is near Gainesville. And I sort of feel, you know, in an ideal world, there'd be so many of these enormous trees that we wouldn't be able to even distinguish between which ones are the largest. So there's something a little sad in the fact that we have to, you know, that we erect these plaques and know which one's the largest. But at the same time, you know, that is the world we live in. So I liked that. You know, I like that we take a moment to appreciate the particularly fine oak trees that are still around us. I learned all sorts of amazing things about oak trees, like little factoids, that, you know, the first national forests were actually near Pensacola, and they were planted by the U.S. Navy because live oak trees were particularly useful for shipbuilding. Mm-hmm. Old Ironsides, key parts of the hull for Old Ironsides, it's still in Boston Harbor, were built from live oak trees, lumber. So there are all sorts of interesting ways in which live oak tree, the story of live oak trees and the story of us, that we're connected to that story. And that's really what the book sort of showed me doing the research to the book, that our story is connected to the story of nature. Often we see nature as this place that's set aside.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience and also through my research, it was constantly impressed upon me how our story and the story of the environment is connected, not always or even usually maybe in wonderful ways,
right?
But certainly connected.
Well, I guess our discussion of live oaks wouldn't be complete without you mentioning the oldest live oak in the state and where it is and its size.
Yes, it's called a Ceylon oak. I think I'm pronouncing it right. It starts with a C. And it's very close to the University of Florida in Gainesville. I don't have directions to the place right out on my tips, but it's very, very easy to locate. It's a beautiful spot, actually, a great place to take a picnic. And, you know, I part of that, my chapter on these trees, I document my trip that I took with my kids and my wife to see this oak tree. And I was worried that they'd be bored and they wouldn't really be that interested. But there was a lot to do under there. There's some beautiful pecan trees still on that property, too. And you see this oak, and it's just, I mean, I have a picture of it in the book, but it really doesn't do justice to how big the tree actually is when you're there. And it's something really to think about, you know, that this tree was there, you know, before Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an amazing, when you think about that, like what that tree has seen, there's something awesome about that.
If only it could talk.
Exactly.
We're speaking with Professor Andrew Furman. He teaches English at Florida Atlantic University and creative writing in their MFA program. And I read that your most recent book is My Los Angeles in Black and Almost White, but
yes.
We're discussing his book, Bitten, My Unexpected Love Affair with Florida. And I wanted to And talk about the screech owls, because that was pretty interesting. You talk a lot about the suburban screech owls, but then your son, for school, decided to build a nest to attract them. So tell us about that, and did it work?
That's probably my favorite chapter, because it was really all happening at the time that I was writing it. And at first, my son, it was actually for a Boy Scout project, that he just approached me. He was 13, I think, at the time. And he said, oh, we need to build a screech owl nest box. And it was just out of the blue. And first of all, I was just thrilled that, you know, my son wanted to spend any time with me at all. It was great as a 13-year-old. And, you know, I just thought this would end in disaster because, you know, I'm not particularly handy. But as I mentioned earlier in the show, we got online and we found these building plans, and I found, like, the easiest one that I could imagine building that you make just from one plank of wood. And it went really without a hitch. I mean, we were able, and if I was able to do it with my son, then pretty much anybody could build these nest boxes. And we put it up in a tree about 15 feet, which is what they recommend for owls. And it's interesting that the book was to press before the breeding season came up again. So nothing had happened at the point the book went to press. So in that chapter, it didn't work yet in the chapter, but my daughter, my older daughter, who was about 10 at the time, is the first one who saw the owls at night, saw them flitting across the foliage, and then saw them go into that box. And so it was an amazing experience just enjoying that first pair, that first year breeding, really. And they bred, and three owlets fledged, and they hung around the house, and we have nine oak trees on the property. And it's a very small house, actually, but it's about a quarter acre little corner lot. But we do have several trees, and they stayed all summer. And then I think it was a different couple bred this year and fledged too. So we did have one incident with bees trying to set up residence, which wasn't very pleasant, but
in the nest?
Yeah. So we had to take care of that issue. But we've noticed, if you do these little, once we did that, that's when we started to take more of an interest in them. And it's interesting how contagious it was. We had people in the neighborhood on their walks would always stop by and to watch the owls too, and then we'd strike up conversations. So it was really a bonding experience for the neighborhood, I think. It's been that way since we've had that nest box up. And we've noticed as we walk in the neighborhood that other people have put up nest boxes.
That's great.
Yeah.
What other critters have you been? And it sounds like you weren't enamored of critters very much before you got here, and now you are.
I don't know if I wasn't enamored of certain critters.
Oh, okay.
But I was always, I actually grew up in Los Angeles, and I always was sort of interested in birds, but, you know, I wasn't really a bird watcher, until graduate school, and then when I came down here. Florida is a real hotspot for bird watching, and because we are in this flyway, and it's a place where a lot of birds winter. So a lot of bird watching friends from the Northeast, who visit me and give me a lot of lessons on what birds I need to be looking for and where I can find them. And then fishing was something that I developed, my interest in fish developed much later, I think, really within the last 6-7 years. I had been here about 10 years before I finally started hearing about these fish, and I had a colleague who was a pretty avid fisherman, and I figured, I really should learn about this aquatic realm that's right, in my backyard as well, and so that's been a recent passion.
Did you ever catch the snook yet?
No, part of it is I don't really target them. There's something about them that I just don't really want to catch one, I think is really what it comes down to, because they struggle a bit, with the cold spells that we have.
Uh-huh.
And there's a very limited, you could only keep the regulations as a limited season, and you could only keep one, and it has to be within a certain slot size. And I sort of figure that if a fish needs that many regulations, maybe I should just leave them alone.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, but I do. But I do go out with other people who do catch them, and I've seen other people catch them, and they're really amazing, amazing fish.
So, what is your very favorite? Do you have a favorite Florida place that you go and visit? Is it the Everglades? Is it?
Mm-hmm. Well, those places, that varies over the years, actually. But I'll tell you the place that I'm sort of fascinated with now that really occupies my imagination is, it's a place, it has a long name. It's called the Dagny Johnson Key Largo Hammock Botanical State Park. How's that for a mouthful?
Okay.
But the reason why I'm so fascinated by that place, it's in northern Key Largo. And most people will just drive right past it, because most people, when they go to the Keys, would take U.S. 1 the whole way.
Uh-huh.
But if you turn right after Florida City, you can turn left on Card Sound Road, it's called.
Right.
And you go over a bridge. You might be familiar with this. You have to pay $1, I believe, to go over the bridge. And then you head down from there. After the bridge, you will turn right at a T, and you head down. You're on northern Key Largo at that point. And on the left, that whole area of about 3,000 acres of hardwood hammock had been slated for development really since the 50s. There were all sorts of court cases and whatnot, where there were all these sorts of plans to really have an enormous city really there. And the most recent battle was in the early 80s. There was and developers actually won a protracted court case to build a development called Port Bougainvillea. And construction started, and thankfully they went bankrupt.
Oh.
So and then after that, the state, the Miami Herald actually had a very heroic role in this, where they covered it and were really against the development from the get-go. But it started, but then they went bankrupt, and the state and various agencies were able to buy the property. Dagny Johnson, who was named for, was a private citizen who was a lawyer and a very key environmentalist who was fighting the good fight at that time. And so now, so they bought it, and you could walk through. It's the site, it's almost hard to believe, but they say it's the site of the greatest tree diversity in the United States. So they're not huge, you know, sequoias, but it's an amazingly diverse, 2,000 acres worth of gumbo limbos and mahoganies and poison woods.
Are they labeled?
And some of them are labeled. There's a great walking trail. You can actually bring a dog on a leash if you want. And you see these amazing birds. If you're lucky, you'll see white-crowned pigeons that are specific to that area, to the Keys and the Everglades, that Audubon painted on the Geiger tree. And what's interesting about it, you see a lot of these plants and trees are labeled on a loop that you can take. But at the same time, you see the vestiges of that development. You see like a rock wall peeking out from the foliage. You see an abandoned roadbed. So there's something sort of Planet of the Apes-like about it.
Right.
And it's instructive. You feel it's very sobering, because you see this beautiful natural hammock, but you see what it might have been at the same time. So, and I find it kind of haunting to be there, but very beautiful.
So before we go, would you consider yourself an environmental activist? Have you become one?
I guess that also depends on the activist, label. I do see this. I would say yes, because I see my writing hopefully as activism.
Right.
And so my hope in the book is that the book encourages people to take up a relationship with the environment, their immediate environment. Because I think when people do that, that translates into votes with regard to the environment. I think part of the problem that we have is that people, even that live in Florida, aren't really living in Florida. We live in our climate control interiors. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really forge a connection with the place. And I think the more that we do that, the more that the place will become valuable to us in a way that's not material. So I do think that hopefully my writing plays a small part in encouraging people to develop that relationship.
Well, it's a beautifully written book. We're discussing Professor Andrew Furman's book, Bitten, My Unexpected Love Affair with Florida. And Professor Furman teaches English at FAU and creative writing in their MFA program. And I enjoyed the book. I want to thank you so much for spending that time with us, Professor.
My pleasure.
Okay, and best of luck with the book. It really is beautifully written.
Thank you very much, Bonnie.
Okay, thanks for being with us.
My
Food
pleasure.
And thank you. Food and Dining is next. and welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Well, I was thinking fried chicken, French fries, canned string beans, canned corn, bologna and cheese on white bread, soda to wash it all down.
You're making our guests ill. They're turning green.
Well, I'm thinking that might have comprised a typical school lunch a few decades ago. I know times have changed. We'll find out how. Joining us now, Cordon Bleu chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend Linda Gassenheimer. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Bonnie. Let's get some things straight here.
Okay.
All right. So first of all, we know school started already.
Yes.
And so what's on the menu this year? I think you might be have your ideas changed a little bit.
I see,
yes.
Actually.
Okay. Well, our guests have some news for us. Penny Parham is the Director of Food and Nutrition for the Miami-Dade County Schools. Welcome, Penny.
Hi. Thank you, Linda. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have to straighten Bonnie out a little bit.
Yes.
And Mary Mulder is Director of Food and Nutrition Services for Broward Schools. Welcome, Mary Mulder.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation this afternoon.
Great to have you. And we'd love to have you, our listeners, join us as well. Do you have any questions or maybe some comments? It's your chance to talk to these people. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Do we have email today, Bonnie?
We do. It's radio@WLRN.org. We also have our Twitter, which is @topicalcurrents.
Okay, so it's working today. Great. And also with us, of course, is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. He gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can find in today's Miami Herald. And you can also read Fred's wine column. It's now on Saturdays in the Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, I kind of feel like I ought to come to the defense of bologna.
I'm sorry, Fred. I was thinking I think I insulted bologna now.
Yeah, but I guess I'm not. Instead, I'll just talk about what kind of things to have drinking for Labor Day.
Okay. All right, sounds good. Well, let's start with Penny Parham. Penny, what's new in the Dade County Schools this year?
Well, we have a lot new, and you know, we had a great opening of school. We were very excited about last week going so well and looking forward to a good year. Honestly, where do we start? We've really worked very hard on getting the fresh fruits and vegetables, as you know, not just through the new federal guidelines, but a lot of our own initiatives. And this year, we're really concentrating on how we serve our meals, making sure the kids really get to see the green, get to see the fresh fruits and vegetables, and get to make those choices through new equipment and merchandising and a new food truck that I'm excited to share, and also working on a new tray.
Okay. And we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, but I want to get to Mary. But we brought some food in the studio, and Bonnie looked at it and said, hey, there's green here. Mary Mulder, what's going on in Broward County?
Thank you, Linda, again, for having me this afternoon. I think our biggest update actually references our first annual food show that we had for some of our students last year in February. This was an opportunity, and actually the idea came from my counterpart, Penny, in Dade County. We had our first annual food show. We had students have the opportunity to experience not only food tasting, but the analytical process involving technology of helping us assist in menu planning. We had vendors come in, vendors set up, students walk through an organized process, actually taste food items, and then input their
thoughts. So they got to help decide what you're going to plan for the...
Exactly.
Mm. So it resulted... were they pleased with it?
It was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. They're assisting in our menu planning. We were able to take the data from the actual food show and plan our menu. We have items on the menu now that we didn't have, such as chicken wings that are baked, not fried. We're having empanadas on our menu. We're having a chicken pita at breakfast. We're also having some shrimp poppers on our menu. So all things that students had an opportunity to taste and positively enjoy will now be shown on our menu.
It became theirs because they were involved in it.
Exactly.
Which is a great idea.
And we will be expanding it this year.
Well, you know, you mentioned breakfast. So I say every year that I know in Dade County, Penny, you have... a free breakfast for every child. It's not need-based.
That's right. Our universal free breakfast program we have in every school. We try to reach the kids through grab-and-go breakfast, of course, hot breakfast items in the cafeteria. And it's definitely, you know, we look at breakfast as everybody needs it for a good performance and to support achievement. And it's at no charge to every student.
And so the oldest, the grab and goes for all the schools, high schools or
That's
secondary
right.
schools or everybody?
No, we have grab and go items on the menu at every school.
Wow, yeah. Fantastic. Mary, what's going on up in Broward with breakfast?
With breakfast, we're also expanding the grab and go program with breakfast. We are implementing it in our secondary schools. We're actually starting expanding it in some of our elementary schools with principal input. Again, the goal is to provide breakfast for students. Hungry students cannot learn. So we're putting new items on the menu, putting new breakfast models to ensure that students have the opportunity when they're on campus to have breakfast before classes start.
So, in fact, I always wonder why parents don't take advantage of it, those who don't, because they can leave their children early at school and get on to work.
Yeah, I mean, it helps logistically in the morning. They know it's tough, but I think that's part of it. You know, sometimes people like to have breakfast at home, and we actually encourage that. We really just encourage a healthy breakfast and have it available at school so that the logistics are covered. And like Mary mentioned, we support the students through their academic day.
Okay, so now we mentioned the food truck. We mentioned this food here in the studio. And so, Penny, this looks like a gorgeous display here.
Is from our food
truck. It's on Instagram, by the way. Anybody wants to see it, I photographed, put it on Instagram.
Well, you know, when we were talking about it earlier, Linda, when we came in, I really want to emphasize it is about the how we're serving the food. You know, we've worked so hard on what the food is, you know, working to get the grilled chicken and get, you know, the baked chicken wings were something we did some promotions with last school year. They're incredibly popular, all baked, you know, not fried, not greasy.
Mary's sitting here.
Because what happens is collaboratively, when we can set these trends, other districts throughout the country can take advantage of it. And that's something we're working on with our partners around the country. But why I say the how is that what we've discovered is that we have good food. We have, you know, fresh produce. Our employees work real hard. They cook it fresh in the kitchens. I know they do in Broward County too. But sometimes it's not presented in a way that the kids can easily see it or easily make the best healthy choice or even sometimes pay attention. You know, they're kids. So we're really
sort of
working on eating
with our eyes.
Eating with our eyes and how it's presented. I think it's super fun on the food truck because we use the boat with the deli paper, and the kids love it, and the how they're getting their meal served.
When you say boat, we're talking about it's a cardboard
right.
boat. The kinds of things you might get in a fast food place.
Well, I don't know. I haven't been in a fast food place in a really long time, but I will tell you that I know.
I knew that. I knew that, Penny.
But I know.
Neither have I.
Right? But I do know that makes it, on a food truck, which I have visited, you do get served that way. And it's just a different setup.
Definitely. Yeah. I just want to concur with Penny on the food. The fresh fruits and vegetables have been such a promotion for both districts and actually all districts throughout the country for the past several years that we're serving fresh honeydew, cantaloupe, strawberries, blueberries, baby peppers, carrots.
Mm. How are you affording all of that? Those are expensive things to be serving.
You are correct, but it's purchasing power. We're large districts. We have menu planning. We have menu planners, dietitians on staff that ensure that we're following the USDA regs, but also look at the vendors through our purchasing departments.
So that's really, really fresh.
Well, that's also here. I had shown, I know we're on the radio, but this is the pineapple cuts that we've tested the last 2 days.
And they look beautiful. She's got a whole basket full of these beautiful fresh cut pineapples.
But when you ask about the affordability, it's just, as Mary said, plus every week we price the produce that we buy. So sometimes we have the ability to buy a more variety, where other times of the year it's just not there. And what we want to make sure is that not only is it that it's affordable, but that it's affordably used. In other words, that we can effectively spend our money on the healthy food and make it convenient for the staff to serve and readily there for the kids.
Right.
So that's why it's cut and packaged. You open this, it's all open to serve, and it's completely fresh pineapple.
So they just get it that way. We have a phone call here on line one. Hello, Marilyn. You're on the air. Coconut Grove.
Hi. I wanted to comment about my wonderful experience with hot lunch before, I guess, the prepackaging and pizza and that kind of stuff came along.
Go ahead. Yes. If it's a wonderful experience, I'm sure they'd like to hear it.
Well, exactly. They were real people, really nice women who actually prepared the food for us. And people looked forward to it.
Now, are you talking about your school experience?
Yeah, in school.
When you were in school.
Exactly.
Well, they still do have hot lunches, I think.
Oh, yes, I know. Yes. But increasingly, they're not actually prepared by humans. There are a lot of prefab ingredients.
Oh, well, just hold on. We've got some people here who would like to talk to you.
Well, I do have to say, Marilyn, you're right. Our people are amazing, and actually, it's one of the things we work very hard at is our staff development. This summer, for the last 6 years, our department at Miami-Dade pays our employees to come in over the summer for what we call our Summer Training Institute, because our cafeteria workers are amazing. I mean, they work behind the scenes. They see all the kids at the school, and they do prepare the food fresh.
Right, fresh.
Brown rice and the America. Spaghetti casserole, yes.
Well, if I can agree with Penny, yeah. We also focus on customer service, mm-hmm. And the way our staff interacts with students. We have training prior to school starting. We work on customer service throughout the year. We ensure that all these products are fresh items. We have fresh salads on. That are made daily. We have fresh subs that are made daily. So we have a lot of those items are still occurring in the schools.
Exactly. Right. It may not be the exact same items of
you know. Is the school open if people want to come and see what's going on, if they feel that they're not sure what's happening in the school lunches?
Well, we always invite parents. It's through the principal. In fact, on Walk Your Child to School Day, which is coming up this October, all parents are invited to walk their children to school, and then we invite them in for breakfast. Of course, schools have their operational standards, so people go to through the front office, but definitely we have lots of employees.
Maybe that's what Marilyn might want to do. Okay, well, thank you for your call. Thank you so much.
I wanted to mention one more thing.
Yes?
There was a downside. We had to eat a lot of Spam.
Well, I don't think they have to do it now.
Well, I think it was left over from World War II.
Right.
We had it baked and barbecued and potatoes.
Baked and barbecued Spam with potatoes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've come a long way.
Okay.
Thank you for your call.
Sure.
Thank you. All right. So just to get back to this truck for a minute. It doesn't go everywhere, but you are trying to, Penny, build up a
it's one hot mobile food truck. We do have a fleet of delivery vans. I know I was showing you the photo.
Yes, so you're going to be working on it. That's great. Well, let's just go to a break for a minute. There's so much we want to say. My guests are Penny Parham from the Dade County Schools and Mary Mulder from Broward Schools. We're talking about back-to-school food. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking with Penny Parham, Director of Food and Nutrition for the Miami-Dade County Schools, and Mary Mulder, Director of Food and Nutrition Services for Broward Schools. We've been talking about school lunches, breakfasts, and all kinds of delicious happenings going on at the schools. But talking about healthy students, several local chefs are participating in Chefs Up Front. It's a benefit dinner at the Biltmore Hotel. It's going to be on September 5th, and it benefits Cooking Matters. Now, that's a nutrition education and cooking program that's offered by the nonprofit Flippin' Eat. Sounds like a lot going on, but it's really a worthwhile event, a worthwhile cause. And so for more information, go to flippineat.org. That's FLIPANY.org for this event at the Biltmore. Raise funds for them. Okay, dinner in minutes time. All right, so I'm not going to give you a school dinner in minutes because it's Labor Day coming up this weekend. And here's a different take on burgers if you'd like a different, add something to your repertoire. Salmon burgers with hot pepper corn. And they only take a few minutes to make. I cook them in a skillet for make it quick and easy. But if you have your grill fired up, then use your grill. But I suggest you get a small grill grate to cook them on. So I use fresh salmon, and I cut it into cubes and put it in the food processor. And then I also add some defrosted chopped onion and green bell pepper. Now, I use the frozen because it saves on prep time, but if you want to use fresh, that's fine too. I add some breadcrumbs and an egg white, and I make them into patties, and I cook them for about 4 minutes aside and put them on a toasted burger bun. For the hot peppercorn, I boil the corn for just about 3-4 minutes. That's all you need, corn on the cob, and I roll it in hot pepper jelly. That makes a complete meal. That complete recipe is at dinnerinminutes.com with a photograph. And if you'd like another quick dinner, in today's Miami Herald, I have my grilled pork with plum salsa. Now, plums are nearing the end of your season. They're good now, so it's a good way to use them. And that also has a grilled corn on the cob recipe as well. So it's in today's Miami Herald. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, I think I'll talk about drinks for Labor Day, just as you talked about food for Labor Day. Of course, to a lot of people, Labor Day is the best holiday of the year because kids are excited that they can get out of the house and go back to school. And parents are excited that their kids can go back to school and get out of the house. So now parents can put up their feet in the field of the liberation of quieter days and indulge in more adult libations. And I have a couple of suggestions. In the spirits category, I note that looking back over the past 100 years, the peak of the hurricane season in South Florida arrives on September 10. So, of course, the time to toast that is now. It's certainly not during the storm. And New Orleans has a drink in its honor called the Hurricane, which was invented by a French Quarter bar owner to use up the cheap rum his distributors made him buy in order to get the scotch and gin that he really wanted. And today it's made with 151 proof rum, coffee liqueur, Irish cream, and Grand Marnier. So that's as powerful as a gale wind. Now, if you want wine, I'd go with the local stuff from Schnebly's Fruit Winery in the Redland. Of course, Schnebly's has a wine it calls a Category 3 Hurricane, which is a blend of lychee, guava, and carambola, which sounds pretty good. And if you want beer, Schnebly has opened a brewery. I hadn't known that before. And you can get a lemon-scented wheat ale there called Shark Bait.
A lemon-scented wheat ale?
That's right.
Okay.
Kind of unusual. And this is in case that inevitable September hurricane blows up one of those newfangled Sharknadoes that you see in the movies.
I see. Now, have you already been drinking most of this, it sounds like.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, we do well up here. We do okay.
I'm sure.
Although on a more serious note, of course, these drinks are for well before or after a hurricane, not during one. I know when I first got to Miami decades ago, I thought hurricanes were really cool. And I had a hurricane party or two. But then Hurricane Andrew came and blew my house down to the bare concrete blocks. I was in a shelter at the time, so I was okay, but some people I knew stayed in their house and had a hurricane party. And halfway through the storm, they panicked and tried to run through the storm to the shelter, and they had to turn back, and they spent a couple of hours in real terror. So save the parties for after the storm when things are safe again.
All right. Well, that sounds good idea. Delicious. Good idea. And happy Labor Day to you, Fred Tasker.
Yeah, same to you.
Thank you. All right, let's go back with Penny and Mary to the schools and all. I get a lot of people asking me about, you know, healthy foods in school, and I know you both have worked so hard to bring healthy foods in, take sodas out of the vending machines and that kind of thing. What happens now with fundraisers? Because so many of the parents, you know, they need to and they want to raise funds for the band, for the teams, for whatever they want to do, buy things for the school. So what happens with healthy food there?
Well, I can, I'll go ahead, Mary, and mention that in our wellness policy in Miami-Dade Schools, we have a portal on our website at the nutrition.dadeschools.net. It's fantastic. It's called Play, Eat, Succeed, which has all sorts of great wellness information in it, including ideas for healthy fundraisers and really good suggestions for doing things that don't involve food at all. Really great, successful fundraisers that our schools have done include, you know, walkathons and other type of physical activities that don't even require any type of exchange of food. So there's no even need to concern on whether it's an acceptable wellness rule or if it's candy. Fundraisers that don't involve food can actually bring in more funds.
More money.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mary, how are you handling it?
Well, the new state regs came out following the USDA guidelines, and we're transitioning into that. We're alerting our principals to the new standards for exempt fundraising as far as it goes for food items. And we, too, are trending towards items for fundraisers that are non-food so that we don't have that overlap and that schools still have the opportunity to raise funds.
So what are the new regulations?
The new regulations limit the amount of fundraisers for snack items or a la carte items that have a certain calorie content, sodium content, and sugar content. So the guidelines were released, and we're transitioning in both districts to make sure that our schools are in line. We're sending memos out to our principals, alerting our PTAs. And again, it's a transition period because these are new regs that came out from the federal government.
We had the good fortune with us is that our district's wellness policy had already had the same guidelines. In fact, the federal Smart Snack program, with only one small change, was the they actually permit diet sodas and diet carbonated beverages, which we don't. So our snack vending machine contracts and other items had already complied. So in that respect, we were.
So are you getting pushback because you go to a game or go to a music concert after school and the parents are out there selling food?
Well, our wellness policy is for 1 hour after the last dismissal. So if it was a football game at night or a concert in the evening, then of course it's up to the group. You know, the guidelines don't apply. But right after school, right when the bell rings, they do apply. And we work really hard to talk to parents, let parents know that there are other options. Sometimes, you know, everyone's busy and gets used to doing things the way they had been done. And so we work really hard to try to provide information and memos on new ideas and ways they can do it without selling food or within the guidelines.
Mary?
Correct. And we have dietitians that are on staff that are able to guide PTAs, PTOs, principals, and the public to ensure that we're in compliance and, again, to provide those ideas.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And well, last year, we only have about a minute left, but last year it was mandated that you had to have a fruit or a vegetable on a lunch tray. And I know some schools, districts not in Florida, some school districts are saying we won't take federal funding if we have to do that because the food gets thrown out. What are you finding?
Well, we were talking about that earlier. You know what? They're kids. They probably will taste things, but I think we've done a great job of making sure that they take the kind of food they want to eat, and that includes fruits or vegetables.
Okay, and so you're not...
Sure, and that's the exposure to those fruits and vegetables also, to make sure that children have the opportunity to try items that they may not normally see at home.
So at least they'll see it.
Correct.
Right. Okay, well, there's so much more we could talk about, but it's been a wonderful, exciting week here. Penny Parham, thanks so much for stopping by.
Well, thank you, Linda. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Penny is Director of Food and Nutrition for the Miami-Dade County Schools. Mary Mulder, Director of Food and Nutrition Science for Broward Schools. Thank you for taking your time, because it's a busy time, the second week of school for you.
Well, thank you for having us.
So have a great school year, both of you. Bonnie Berman, thank great you. To be with you.
Likewise.
Fred, great advice, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Stay away from that ale, whatever it
and
was.
And keep your fingers crossed about those storms.
Yes.
For us.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. They're out in the Caribbean right now.
Yeah.
Well, next week we'll be talking with Chef Michelle Sanchez from Latin House Grill, how he took his food truck from a food truck to a successful brick and mortar place. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up Topical Currents for today. We thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. And more information, links, photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. You can follow me on Twitter at Bonnie Berman. You can follow Linda at L. Gassenheimer.
Yes.
And dinnerandminutes.com.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Tomorrow at this time, please join Ed Bell for another edition of South Florida Arts Beat. And Monday at this time, tune in for our Labor Day special presentation, Future Work, where a distinguished panel gives listeners insights into how technology will redefine work in the not-too-distant future. Topical Currents returns on Tuesday with an in-depth look at the juvenile justice system's practice of sentencing youths to live their entire lives in prison without parole. We speak with filmmaker Nadine Prequenza. Her new PBS Point of View documentary is 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story. Join us then. Bonnie Berman wishing you a great day and Labor Day weekend. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next.